coming of the Industrial Revolution, a wave of mechanization swept the whole world. However, instead of freeing humanity still further from manual labor, the factories and mines of the new industry meant degradation, drudgery, and child labor. The explosion of material wealth poured out by the machines plunged the cottage industry, the artisan and the craftsman, and some agricultural workers into lives of poverty and starvation. Though surrounded by plenty, the industrial cities threw up the most degrading slums and conditions so well described by authors like Dickens. It took many generations to eradicate the worst of this appalling poverty. Desperate measures were taken. Some groups took to the machines with large sledgehammers. They were called the Luddites. At that time, Marx and Engels took advantage of the critical conditions to foster revolution, and the political movement known as Marxism was born. It continues today, attempting to exploit every vestige of resentment the machine age has left. The harnessing of solar energy proceeded apace, and the face of the earth was absolutely transformed. Dreamers wondered, would the day ever come when a plough would no longer need a horse to pull it? Would the day ever come when a man could fly from one land to another in giant machines? Would the day of the horseless carriage ever arrive? Would the day ever come when a man could travel underneath the sea as envisaged by Jules Verne? It was science fiction material. And would we ever put a man on the moon or on Mars? Well, such dreams are now commonplace and they're taken for granted. It's less than 200 years since George Stephenson built his locomotive that could pull four carriages at the speed of 30 miles per hour. The electronic revolution took over from the machine age. Now the computer age is transforming the face of the earth. The possibilities are endless, and the dreams for the future are fantastic. Will we enter an age in which the office worker and the office itself become obsolete? Such work is being done from home now. Communication link-ups eliminate the need to physically go to work. Will the cities we now know as the concrete jungles become monuments for future generations to wonder about? Perhaps houses will be built underground with artificial sunlight and controlled environments. Shopping by computer could make shopping centers obsolete. Will voluntary votes at computer terminals eliminate the need for elections? Will politicians themselves become extinct? Probably no such luck. With the use of the new electronic technology, the possibilities are endless. Communication becomes easier and easier. Knowledge becomes more and more accessible. And the opportunity for people to try new ideas has expanded incredibly. A few fundamental problems still remain to be solved to free us from the production system. An alternative mechanism for the distribution of wages and salaries is required so that society can consume that which is produced. A national accounting office may need to be developed in order to calculate a national dividend for each person, giving them access to the goods produced by machines. As the efficiency of machines increases and technology advances, the real cost of production in both human and other energy terms will fall. Less and less human energy linked with more and more complex innovation will produce the requirements that we depend on. Less energy and more production efficiency will mean less real cost. If that is the case, then a fairly basic income or national dividend would have to reflect the reducing costs of production. I'm not suggesting that everybody would just lay about and that fruits of our enormous heritage would just fall into our hands. It seems axiomatic that everybody who benefits from our heritage should also be expected to contribute in some way to the advancement of that heritage for future generations. Each able-bodied adult might be required to make a contribution to the production system. However, the length of this service could become shorter and shorter. Instead of working from the age of 18 until retirement at age 65, a worker may only be required to work to age 40 before retirement is offered. It would be desirable and probably necessary to make retirement voluntary because some people have a genuine regard, a certain feel for the kind of work they do. To some people, in fact, their work is actually their leisure. The circumstances must be fairly rare, but take, for example, the life of a test cricketer. Is a test cricketer working, or is he pursuing a hobby in his leisure time? That might be a more and more difficult question to resolve. In the new age of leisure, craftsmanship would flourish. The cottage industries would probably return in a different form, with the use of new technologies and with much production resulting from a constructive kind of hobby. If voluntary unpaid effort becomes a part of economic production and grows so that there is sufficient for all needs, then work, as we define it, will no longer exist. What then will become of the working class? The new elite will probably be those who have built the most productive and admired leisure activities, those who produce the most sought-after services and goods. Is it possible that we could develop an aristocracy of service that seeks only appreciation? Hey, you may say, isn't this all going a bit far? Well, how long is the future? And who can speak for it? Each only speaks for his own. How quickly and with what acceleration of technology are we travelling? Then what sort of world are we coming to? Social services, given an increasing national dividend, would probably progressively become less necessary and would probably disappear altogether. Taxation would become merely a pittance and hardly worth the effort of avoiding. As each of us became more able to look after ourselves, our families, and our extended families, the role of government would naturally diminish. With the development of such a free society, you'd expect that such things as education would become the preserve of highly committed and motivated teachers, people with a spiritual dimension, as it was traditionally, when all early Western education grew out of the churches. Regulations would decrease, legislation would become less necessary to maintain good order in a stable, free population. In a society where each individual has a certain amount of economic freedom through receipt of a national dividend, it becomes more and more difficult to centralize power in one particular place. It becomes more difficult because it's not easy to intimidate a free and independent person. We would then even have the time to indulge our fascination for the past. Sometime in Sydney, a group of steam train enthusiasts got together and bought a steam locomotive number 3801. They formed the 3801 company and restored the locomotive to its original working order. They now run excursions out of Sydney on public holidays and weekends, creating intense interest wherever they go. When Britain's locomotive wonder, the famous Flying Scotsman, was in Australia in 1989, the 3801 company coupled their locomotive with the Flying Scotsman and travelled up to Mossvale on a Sunday. They stopped for lunch in the sleepy little village at Robertson, in the middle of the bush, and suddenly people came from everywhere to see two steam locomotives. Hundreds of people were drawn for a glimpse of the engineering marvels of a past age, before plastics were invented, or before obsolescence was built into our products. There seems to be an increasing hunger for the standards, both moral and engineering standards, of an age that produced such things as steam travel. With leisure time freely available, the pursuit of excellence, whether it's in engineering or literature or music or any form of craftsmanship, would not only be possible, but it would be inevitable. It would be inevitable because man is made in the image of his creator, with an instinct to be creative. But excellence and creativity require time, and it is time that modern society and the modern social organism don't have. When you consider the advantages we have, you must agree that this is rather curious. There is a sense in which time is an unlimited resource, and yet it is the one resource that we claim to have least of. The true nature of leisure is not spending time, but investing it in the future. Doesn't it strike you as odd that so many prefer their time to be dead, and when they have time to spare, they speak of killing time? It seems to be a reflection of the age in which we live, where almost nothing is made for really long-term satisfaction. If you had time to invest, what would you invest it in? Perhaps in your family. It's blatantly obvious that we need to invest time in our children, and what a pleasure it is when we do it. Or would you invest it in building your own home, reflecting your own individual tastes and creativity, trying some new ideas? Perhaps you would prefer to improve your mind by learning a language, or a new discipline like law, or mechanics, or even medicine. Or perhaps you would travel. C. Barclay Smith, an Australian writer, once worked out that the average person could learn to speak and read fluent German and French in just 30 hours a week over 12 months. By using that 30 hours a week consistently, he or she could become expert in 1 year in almost any phase of their employment. 30 hours a week would make any person something of an amateur authority at the end of that year on almost any subject like astronomy, psychology, the Greek classics or history, or philosophy. It would enable the ordinary person to do one of the following things. You could read approximately 150 biographies. You could become familiar with practically all the works of the English poets, or you could become well-versed in the theory and history of music. Otherwise, you could read 50 of the world's greatest works of fiction. Alternatively, you could become reasonably skilled, for an amateur, in pottery work, clay modelling, wood carving, drawing, painting, tapestry, rug weaving, cabinet making, or any of the many other things, assuming, of course, you had an interest in them. So, spending free time constructively has enormous potential and great possibilities, and the most marvellous thing is, it's never too late to begin. It doesn't matter how old you are. Some of the greatest achievements have actually been realized in advanced age. One of the best-known biological works is the Natural History of the Invertebrates, which was written by Lamarck. He finished that enormous work at the age of 78. Cato learned Greek at the age of 80. And Queen Victoria mastered the Hindustani language. In music, Verdi was 74 when he wrote Othello, and 80 when he composed Falstaff. His famous Ave Maria was written on his 86th birthday. Plato wrote his Republic in about his 80th year, and Goethe, the greatest master of the German language, finished Faust on the eve of his 83rd birthday. Cervantes, the author of The Man of La Mancha, who gave us Don Quixote, never wrote anything until in his 80s. That's not saying that we are all in that particular class, but everyone has some talent to develop, which would be a valuable contribution to the community. Even things that are often regarded as something of a curse to us at the present time could be used to better advantage. Take television, for example. For the most part, television is positively destructive in its effect on the human mind, even if only from the point of view of wasting time. How many of us come home from work in the evening and say to the television, "There you are, take my mind and look after it until I need it at 7:30 in the morning." We waste years and years of our lives, and that's not to take into consideration the rubbish that is poured into our minds through propaganda. But television could be used constructively. It could be used to educate people. It could be used as a marvelous means of communication. With free time and with people investing their talents in that medium, anything could happen. There would even be a change in the perception of the human identity. At present, when you meet people on social occasions, they ask you what you do. They identify you by your occupation. Nobody ever asks you, well, what are you really like? Or who are you? They always ask what you do for a living. If you didn't have to do anything for a living, what sort of response would you give? You could say, "I'm a keen gardener," or "I'm a political agitator for freedom potentials." You could say any number of things, but your identity would no longer be established through occupation. It would no longer be necessary or even possible for many women to feel left out or inferior simply because they don't depend on an occupation for an identity. I'm certain that education would undergo dramatic changes. At the present time, education is dominated by the state and the need for a meal ticket. The determining feature is the demand to find some little niche in the workforce which is now less and less dependent upon human labour. A New Zealand lady was about to send her son to school for the first time. She wondered what her child was going to learn and how he was going to turn out. She wrote to the Director General of Education in New Zealand and asked him, "What is the purpose of the education system that I'm sending my child into?" The Director General wrote back saying, "The purpose of education is to prepare a young child for the experience of life. That is what we aim for." And on the face of it, she thought that was fair enough. But after giving it further thought, she asked herself, "Well, what is the purpose of life? What is his conception of the purpose of life? After all, I'm going to submit my child to his perception." So she wrote again and asked him. He replied after a considerable time, stating, "We really don't have any answer to that question. I'm a public servant. It's not my job to have a point of view on philosophical questions. You are asking me about the purpose of life. That is a philosophical question. You'll have to go somewhere else for the answer to that." The Director General was confident he knew the answer to the purpose of education, all right. It's just that he had no idea of the meaning of his answer. The prospect of achieving such a purpose is nil. The point is that education is not merely a mechanical thing. Teaching is a mechanical thing. You can teach dogs to chase sheep. You can teach lions to jump through hoops. But that's not really genuine education. Education is teaching people to learn for themselves. It is more to do with drawing the learning ability out of students than pushing facts and figures into them. It's therefore something of a deeper philosophical thing than just training. This is why in the West, education was originally the preserve of the church. it was not only because the clerics were the first to be able to read and write. It was also because education itself had to deal with such questions as, what is the purpose of man? What is the purpose for which we train ourselves? In that age, the church was the centre of learning. It was really the centre of culture in Europe. It was an age in which men understood and agreed among themselves that the purpose of man was actually a spiritual purpose, not a mechanical purpose at all. The ultimate purpose of man was not simply to be able to feed himself and clothe and shelter himself. Those were the basics. The ultimate purpose of man was a spiritual purpose, and the Christians believed that the purpose was to glorify God with craftsmanship, with tremendous architecture, and with the development of the person who is made in the image of God, self-development. At the present time, the education system is largely distorted and stunted because of our preoccupation with the wrong objective. The present overriding objective is to train somebody so they can become a small cog in the great workforce machine. There they will spend the rest of their lives supposedly doing something constructive and making a contribution to society. But the problem is that with the introduction of mechanization and electronic technology, human labor is less and less required. So what happens to those people whose function becomes obsolete? When the age of the horse-drawn carriage was passed, the Clydesdales were simply put out to pasture and were quite happy. But man is a more complex being. You cannot just put him out to pasture when he's no longer required. Man requires spiritual development, which can only come through education. So I am convinced that in the new leisure age, education would undergo a revolutionary transformation. In ancient Greece, education was a far different thing from what we have today. In some of the great Greek universities, one did not go for 2 or 3 years to get a degree, to do a specific task. One went to learn to educate oneself. If you qualified to go to a Greek university, you went there for life. You studied under the greatest masters that civilization knew. You studied all the great classics and all the great disciplines. An educated person was far different from someone who, as we see today, has a degree in psychology or sociology, and as a result may well claim the right to do all kinds of odd things to the minds of children. Traditionally, the church has had a lot to say about the difference between work and leisure and the balance required for healthy living. As long ago as 1955, Bishop Fulton Sheen had this to say: man does not exist for the sake of production, but production exists for the sake of man. No wonder that people are sick and tired of it. They feel that all they do when they work is to make money in order that they may eat, then eat in order that they may have the strength to go back to work again. Coffee is thrown into the ocean, milk poured on the ground, grain stored, bananas thrown into the sea. And why? Because the maintenance of an economic price has become more important than human life. A few years before that, a French Christian philosopher, Daniel Rotz, was writing in Towards a Truly Christian Society about the production system. He said, "The aim of an economic regime is not to increase production for production's sake, nor to increase capital. Its aim should be to make it possible for man to dwell on this earth at ease, in harmony and brotherhood." St. Francis of Assisi was a saint, revered by Christians of all denominations. He's even admired by atheists and agnostics because associated with his name is a kind of benevolent humanitarianism, and because his poetic nature appeals to the human imagination. But it's very strange that such a man should be revered, because in the sense that our society understands the term work, he was a complete waster. From youth onwards, Assisi didn't do a day's work for the rest of his life. St. Francis appreciated profoundly the true meaning of leisure and used it to develop the spiritual side of his life. Self-development, which the church in those ages called sanctification or personal sanctification, is otherwise known as, of course, holiness or wholeness. It's unnatural for a man to have his whole life dominated by a concern about time. I'm sure time is one of the resources we have that is least understood. I believe that man is uncomfortable with time because it's not really his true environment at all. So we are always complaining about it. I never have time for this, I never have time for that. How time flies. When I saw you last, you were only a little boy. We seem to be the only living organism that complains about the environment in which we live. A fish never makes any attempt to get out of water because that is his environment. That's where he belongs. So if we are not in our true environment, then what is our true environment? If time is not our true environment, then the opposite of that must be. And the opposite of that is timelessness. So you could say that, ultimately, man's true environment is eternity, if you take the Christian view. So, in conclusion, it is clear that modern man has now reached a point where he must make a conscious choice. He can choose a production system that is designed to serve and lead us all into a new golden age of freedom and leisure, in which it becomes increasingly easy for man to love his neighbour as himself. Alternatively, he can turn his back on that and require that the production process keep us busy, keep us employed, keep us occupied for the rest of our mortal lives. In making our choice, we may need to take into consideration that changes are required in other areas, especially in the role of the state and the role of the government. In 1937, Leon Trotsky, one of the fathers of the communist movement, wrote the book called The Revolution Betrayed, in which he said, "In a country where the sole employer is the state, opposition means death by slow starvation. The old principle, who does not work shall not eat, has been replaced by a new one. Who does not obey shall not eat." It seems that much is involved in our choice of an objective for economic activity, either one or the other, and the time has come to make it.